Have you ever so much wanted good in someone else's life that you'd do just about anything? You'd sell what you have, you'd go anywhere, you'd beg, you'd scream, you'd plead, you'd pray, whatever you needed to do to accomplish that good in another person's life. Well, I think that's the way it was for Nehemiah. Nehemiah, who had been for 12 years away from the city of Jerusalem, tending to his other job as prime minister, as cupbearer to King Artaxerxes in Babylon, but who was reassigned to Jerusalem, and when he came, was flabbergasted to see the effects of the bad marriages in the Jewish community. His response was interesting. He was so upset that he cursed them. He took some of them and beat up on them. He took a few of them and even pulled out their hair. Now, he probably would have difficulty getting a job as a marriage counselor here today. He used what modern therapists would call a directive approach to the needs of the marriages of those peoples. And while, of course, I am not endorsing that style of Nehemiah for today, I do appreciate his commitment to right marriages. And frankly, I think the number of Nehemiahs ought well increase in our time so that we would have more who would speak for God as God recalls his people to covenant marriages. Well, from Nehemiah 13 that we have already read this morning, let us consider God's call to covenant marriages then and now. In an earlier chapter, and a couple of decades before in history, in Nehemiah chapter 10, the people of God had promised that they would live life God's way. In fact, they had taken a public oath where they had one by one come before all of the congregation of Israel, 40-some thousand people, and signed on in their promise that they would obey God's commandments, that they would be different from the people around them, and they would live out a covenant relationship with God, making them a distinctive people in their allegiance, in their obedience. But then while they kept it for a while under Nehemiah's rule, when he returned to Jerusalem after a 12-year absence, the oath had been broken. The promise had not been kept. The people had gone so far as to allow a man named Tobiah, who was not a believer and not part of the Jewish community, who was actually an enemy of Nehemiah and of the Hebrew people, to move into the city of Jerusalem. And if that wasn't bad enough, to actually take up residence, setting up an apartment in the temple itself, where once that warehouse space had been used for the supplies as part of the temple worship of the Lord. And then when the Sabbath day came around, Nehemiah looked, and here the people were living just like everyone else. They didn't take the day off as God had commanded them to do. It wasn't reserved for worship or for rest, but simply was a day of merchandising and labor, just like all the heathen people around who did not have God's law. But he also observed that intermarriages had taken place between Jews and non-Jews, Jews and foreigners. Most significantly, between those who were part of the covenant relationship with God and those who were not. And that is what upset him the most and got the most ferocious of the reactions. He saw it for himself, he says in verse 23. I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Now, if you look at verse 27, you'll see that Nehemiah describes such marriages as terrible wickedness and as unfaithfulness to God. That even more than the matrimonial aspects of that which they were about was the fact that they had broken a covenant relationship with God by entering into a binding marital relationship with other people that weren't part of the covenant with the Lord. Now I try to think, what do you compare that to get an understanding for 1988? Maybe if tomorrow morning's newspapers were to say that Michael Dukakis had divorced his wife in order to enhance his prospects for election to the White House and is going to marry a conservative Republican. Or if Ronald Reagan, trying to match Monday's news, makes it into the headlines on Tuesday saying that he has divorced Nancy so that he can marry a Russian KGB agent. Or other people finding that that seems to be the trend of the day, On Wednesday, we find an article that says that the number one anti-abortion spokesperson in all of America has decided to marry the owner of a chain of abortion clinics. Well, the idea here is that that's inconsistent with who these people are and the relationships that they have had and the commitments that they have made. And so it was for these Hebrew people who had taken an oath of a covenant with God to marry or give their children in marriage to anyone who was not also part of that covenant. It was against God's law, to be sure, but it was inconsistent. It was unthinkable. It was inappropriate. Nehemiah even goes so far in verse 38 to name names. He says that a grandson of Eliashib was the high priest and in terms of office, the highest religious leader and spiritual spokesperson for God and all of the people of Israel. A grandson of Eliashib had married a daughter of Sanballat, and Sanballat was a Horonite. He was not a Jew, and he really could well be described throughout the rest of the book of Nehemiah as Jewish enemy number one. He was opposed to what God was doing among the Jewish people. Incredible that this should take place. A marriage of union, not just between ordinary people, but between the leaders in flagrant disregard of what God had commanded. Then, in verse 29, they not only broke the covenant, but according to Nehemiah, they also polluted the priesthood as well. What had happened? Well, you see, they had loved other people and other things more than they loved God. They had relationships, marriage relationships, which were more important than the covenant. Now, I don't stand here 2,500 years later and think that I'm so perfect and righteous that I can cast stones back to the centuries and say, tisk, tisk, how terrible they were. I think I understand. I understand that there were young people that were making decisions. I understand that they were in love. I understand that they had a lot of contact with these people. The Hebrew people weren't isolated socially. They had all kinds of contacts, and so they built all kinds of relationships. I also understand that far more than today in America, that there in those days, that many of the relationships of marriage were largely arranged by parents. Parents who were concerned about that which was politically appropriate and financially expedient, and that which was socially helpful in climbing the ladder. And so parents would strike up conversations or encourage relationships or function as matchmakers to put together that which they thought was good for their kids and good for themselves, but which totally ignored the commandments of God. How different it was for God. For God sees marriage as something which is at the very core of life. God portrays marriage as one of the most significant tangible expressions of faith. For there is no place else where there is such a covenant intimacy, where there is such danger in ignoring God and such rich fruit in making God central. God counts marriage to be extraordinarily important to him and counts marriage to be far more a covenant with him than with husband and wife. And so to break covenant is to break covenant first with God and only quite secondarily with a man or with a woman. Now, usually within the Bible, there is an expression that there are quick consequences to come from the disobedience that people do in their disregard of God's law. But Nehemiah, in verse 24, takes a somewhat longer view to the consequences that are to come. He considered the children. He describes the children of these mixed marriages of Jews and foreigners and says, my, they can't even speak Hebrew. I understand how old they were. Nehemiah had been away for 12 years. We assume that these marriages did not take place the day that he left, that they must have taken place that year and the next year and the year after. And if you even assume that the children were born in the first year of marriage, the oldest of the children would be 11 or 10 or 9. But they couldn't speak Hebrew. And if they couldn't speak Hebrew, they couldn't read the scripture. If they couldn't speak Hebrew, it meant that they were not part of the temple worship. If they couldn't speak Hebrew, it was hardly likely that they knew the rules of God and the life of faith and the community that bound them together. Hardly was it likely that they knew about, certainly not that they were part of, the covenant relationship with God that he counted to be so extraordinarily important. So that within less than a generation, 12 years, the covenant was gone. It was lost. Now you know that this is still an issue for when Christians marry non-Christians, which God has in the New Testament instructed not to happen. Consequences also may come that are far greater upon the children and the grandchildren than upon the husband and the wife that enter into that covenant. Nehemiah's next point in verse 26 reminds me of a story. Some years ago, Charlene and I and some other people were part of a tour group traveling around Israel, and we were driving north, really back toward the city of Jerusalem, toward the end of a long day, and we had had lots of conversations both about biblical and historical sites and about the political situation in Israel. Many of those conversations included the Israeli guide who was assigned to be with us in a rather large motor coach. And I was sitting right up front on the door side, and not much had been said for a while when that guide turned across the aisle and said to me, "You know whose fault it is?" I had no idea what he was talking about, and I said, "Whose fault, you know, for what?" He said, "All the problems of Israel today, all the problems that we have economically and militarily, and all the problems that we have religiously and the political division, do you know whose fault it is?" Now, you know, I didn't want to intervene in his politics, and I didn't know what he was talking about, really. I didn't know if he was talking about some Israeli politician that's in the Knesset, or I didn't know if he was talking about the prime minister, or Yasser Arafat from the PLO, or King Hussein. I just didn't even want to venture a guess. I don't think he wanted me to either. And then he gave the answer. He says, "Solomon. It's all Solomon's fault." And I didn't want to appear ignorant, so I was just sort of hoping that he would go ahead and give the explanation. And he did. He said, "You know, long ago when Solomon married all those wives," which was a politically expedient thing to do, "who were foreigners and who were not Jews and who did not have a commitment to God, he began all the troubles that we have today." Isn't that an interesting perspective in the 20th century for an Israeli guide? Nehemiah says here that Solomon was the wisest man who ever lived and that God loved him. What more could this man ask for? He was the king in a great dynasty. He had extraordinary wealth. He was the wisest man on earth. People would come from all over the world just to sit at his feet and to hear his proverbs. And he was loved by God. And yet, because of wrong marriages, not only was his kingdom corrupted, but far more significantly, his children and his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, all the way down through the centuries, also were corrupted and suffered the consequences. And you can't tell me that Solomon thought that. He didn't imagine that any more than we do, any more than Eliashib did here in the 13th chapter of Nehemiah. Typically, we're all so pressed, and I am among you, in the issues of today and the decision of what has to be done this afternoon or tomorrow. Hardly do I think of the consequences of what I do in relationship with God's word in terms of 100 or 1,000 years from now. But the consequences do come. Maybe the more practical question, though, is what do you do about it? I mean, what if you've broken the law? For they had broken the law. They had married those whom they shouldn't have married, and their problems with their kids were already showing up. And what should they do? What does anybody do when in a marriage that, after the fact, you say, "I shouldn't have been in this marriage in the first place"? Should these people here in Nehemiah 13 divorce their husbands or wives who were not part of the covenant? Interestingly, in an earlier book in the Old Testament, the book of Ezra, they were instructed to do precisely that, but the results were so disastrous that Nehemiah, I don't even think, would have considered offering that option. What do you do? Well, Nehemiah's answer was you start all over again from where you are. You can't go back. You can't undo what you've done. You can't make the children who have been born go away. You don't get rid of the spouse that you have. You make the best of what you've got. In verse 25, Nehemiah indeed cursed them for their sins and for their stupidity. He even beat up on them and he pulled out their hair. He felt awfully strongly about this. He wanted them to see what they had done. But then he said to them, "Come on, let's take an oath." And they'd already taken an oath, and they'd blown it. They had taken an oath and they had failed to live up to the oath that they had taken. But Nehemiah invited them to take another oath and to start up precisely where they were. An oath to stop the sin that they were committing. In other words, don't make any more of these marriages outside of covenant. Never allow such mixed marriages to take place again, and turn the present marriages into the very best that's possible for God. And then in verse 30, Nehemiah leads in a process of purification, all part of starting up again. Now I take this as a special example to believers in every generation who have blown it, whether in marriage or in some other relationship of life, those who never should have gotten into it in the first place, who perhaps disregarded what God had to say and simply did it anyway and have lived inappropriately and gotten into a mess and broken the covenant. What do you do now? Well, you make an oath and you accept God's purification and you make the best of what you've got and you go on from there and discover God's wonder and God's grace for beginning again. Well, as long as we're on the subject of switching from then until now and from there to here, I think that kind of introduces a pointed question that really is a valid question for us to ask, although most of us are kind of reluctant to be quite so blunt. It is the question of why God makes all these rules that deal with such personal things in our lives as sex and marriage. Isn't that kind of up to us? And why does God give these expectations in Scripture anyway? Well, let me venture at least some possible answers to that, I think, valid question. The first answer is that it's because he wants the best for us. You see, God is our creator, so he knows us better than anybody else. He knows us far better than we know ourselves. He's also our friend. He also loves us. That means, then, that every expectation that God puts upon us is an expectation for our best, for our good. So that when he calls upon us to abstain from sexual union prior to marriage, he does it for our best. Or when he tells Christians not to marry non-Christians, he does not do that because he is somehow trying to punish us, but because he loves us. Because he wants the best for this generation and for future generations as well. Or when he calls upon us to consider marriage to be a covenant with him, it's because he wants the best. And when he tells us within the relationship of marriage to remain faithful, he does that also because he wants the very best for us. So that in every case, he does what he does and asks what he asks, gives the laws that he gives for our best interest. That means then to ignore him or to do otherwise is to reject God's best. About 10 years or so ago, I had a dental appointment that I especially remember. I went to the dentist and, as is the usual custom for the half hour or 40 minutes before, was with the dental hygienist. And there's apparently a three-part process that you go through there. The first part is you're asked if you have any problems, which I've always taken to mean dental problems, although there have been times when thought about talking about some other things. And I always answer by saying, no, everything's fine. I've never had a toothache in my life, for which I am grateful. And so then the second part is cleaning of teeth and go through all the joys of that. And then the third part is a lecture on flossing. And all three parts are doing this. And I don't know exactly where people learn to be dental hygienists, but I know that one of the required courses in the training is humiliation in the field of flossing. And they all do it. It's just part of, and then you pay them, of course, to do that to you. Well, I went to the dentist, and I went through the three stages, and the humiliation process starts out by her saying, "Do you floss every day?" I mean, she just spent half an hour in my mouth. She knew that I don't floss every day. And you can't look somebody in the eye when you answer a question like that, so you sort of look down at your clipped-on thing that they've got in front of you and say, "No, I don't." I never had the nerve to say I did floss this morning. I always floss the day I go to the dentist. But And then the lecture, you know, about how my teeth are all going to fall out and my gums are going to rot and all these terrible things are going to happen to me. And then I go make an appointment, you know, I come back in 6 months and never do it again. And so I listened to this a couple of times over a period of a year and a half. And I decided I'd had it with this. So the next day, I mean, my teeth were clean. They were really, she did a great job. Next morning, I flossed my teeth. And the next, and the next, and the next. I did it every day for 6 months. I didn't miss once in 6 months, which put me in the peculiar circumstance of looking forward to a dental appointment. So I just couldn't wait for the day to go by. I just couldn't wait to see her because I knew what was coming and I was ready. I was going to look her in the eye, practice my answer. I was ready. So I think I got there early. Can you believe that? And they kept me in the waiting room. And I walked down the hall and sat down in the chair. And this other person, whom I've never seen before, comes in. And I said, you know, where's the woman who's usually here? He said, oh, she moved to California a couple months ago. Now, 6 months. I mean, I had flossed my teeth and she moved to California. What right did she have to do that? Now, then I discovered something. And you may think this is rather simple, and maybe you've already made that discovery. But she wasn't giving me these rules and regulations because she benefited by my flossing. Obviously, it was in my best interest. I mean, she was saying that for me. And I discovered that it's for my health, for my benefit, for my long life, for my appearance, for me, that she said what she said and lectured what she lectured and gave the rules that she gave. And it's just that way with God. Sometimes we come to God somewhat distraught because we're going to get a lecture. Because he's going to ask us whether we kept the rules, whether we did what we said we'd do 6 months earlier. And we dread meeting with him. And then afterwards we think, my, isn't he legalistic? He's certainly got a lot of rules. And why is that? And then I dread the next time I'm going to see him. And then one day we discover he says what he says and does what he does because it's best for us. It's true for marriage, it's true for sexual relationships. Frankly, it's true for every dimension of life. That God does what he does and asks what he asks because he wants the best. But you see, there's more to it than that. And that's because God takes a much longer view than we do. And so it's also because he knows the consequences. He's been around, of course, much longer than we have. He knows the past, and amazingly, he can see the future. God knows that when we do things that are contrary to his will and to his way, that we may suffer painful consequences 12 or 20 years into the future. And maybe not even just we, but the generation of children that are to follow. But God also knows the good consequences. God knows that those that are committed to chastity prior to marriage have a greater predictability of success in marriage. God knows that when there are temptations to infidelity, and his power is claimed and those temptations are resisted, that what might otherwise have been a weak marriage can be a strong and a magnificent marriage. God knows that the benefits can be not just for the husband and for the wife in a masterpiece of a marriage that he designs and he makes, but for their children and for their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren and maybe even 2,500 years later. Now look, if you had a broker who could predict the future, who could tell you absolutely for sure what some stock or commodity would do, then my guess is that you would follow that broker's advice explicitly. You would always buy before the boom, and you'd always sell before the bust, and you become a very rich person. And we don't have brokers like that, but we have a God like that. We have a God who knows the future in terms of the booms and the busts of life, and who calls us to live his way, in terms of matrimony, in terms of sexuality, and in terms of the other dimensions of life. The God who loves us and wants the best for us is the God who also knows the consequences. But there's a third answer to that question, and it's also because he is the one who builds the future. You see, he is not just a God for now. He is the God of the future as well. The God for today and for tomorrow and for future generations of our children and our children's children, that God is committed to today, but not just to today, that he is the one who is building for eternity. We here at Wooddale Church have been anticipating the construction of a new building that will be added on to this facility, a worship center. And we hope it to be both a beautiful and a functional structure. If all goes as now is projected, the construction will begin sometime during the month of October. That means then that Bob Rito and Milo Thompson, our architects, and those who work with them, are very busy in the process of completing the working drawings, working long hours in preparing them, because the deadline is just a couple of weeks away when those working drawings are to be finished and then to be examined and then sent out for bids by contractors. Just suppose that the different contractors used different blueprints. I mean, we're going to have lots of different subcontractors here. We're going to have those for electricity and those for mechanical and those for excavation and those for steel and those for finishing and those for just all the different contractors. Now, imagine that at one end of the building they would choose to follow the working drawings that were prepared by the architect, but at the other end of the building they would choose some different drawings. Or suppose that they would decide along the way that they would deviate at this point or that point from the blueprints that were prepared. And so those that are laying block at this end of the building would say, well, we have a lot of extra block, so why don't we make this wall 14 feet instead of 12? And then those that are laying the block at the opposite end of the building say, hey, you know, we're a couple of courses short, but what's a couple of courses one way or the other? We'll just make the wall 10 feet tall. And then some of the electricians decide, well, let's run 110 in this circuit. And others say, ah, come on, let's run 220. Or what of any other point in the building? What would you end up with other than disaster? Absolute disaster. Instead of the dreamed of masterpiece, you would end up with a catastrophe. You see, that's God's rationale when he brings people together in marriage. Not that he wishes them ill, but he understands that a Christian follows a different architect than a non-Christian. A Christian has a different set of blueprints than someone who is not a believer in Jesus Christ. He understood in ancient days that those who were part of the covenant had one set of working drawings and those who were not part of the covenant had another set of working drawings. And he could foresee that that was the making of a disaster, not a masterpiece. As for those who pick up the drawings that God has designed in life and he has given us a rather complete plan in his word, those who say, well, yeah, I know what it says, but I would like to make this wall longer or this wall shorter or put a little more current or a little less current, it is the making of a disaster. When God has drawn for us a masterpiece. The moral of the story, then, is to be smart, to do it God's way, to follow the plan, to build for the future. We have spent 25 Sunday mornings in the Old Testament book of Nehemiah, the better part of 7 months. We close that book, and I suppose, in a sense, we'll not come back to it for a very long period of time. We chose that book in part because, as a church, we're about a building program. But I find something in this 13th chapter, which is my last word on this. I find something absolutely intriguing that three times within the chapter, Nehemiah lifts his head to heaven and speaks to God and says, "Remember me for this, O God." You've got to understand that this guy is one powerful politician. That he is one extraordinarily wealthy leader in the Medo-Persian Empire. You've got to understand that from an historical point of view, he is the one who accomplished the renewal of the Hebrew people and especially the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem. And yet he mentions none of those things. Doesn't mention the wall even once. He says, "Remember me, O God, for worship. Remember me, O God, for obedience and keeping the Sabbath. Remember me, O God, for being committed to making marriages what they're supposed to be." Now, I take that word for us. As a church family, we're going to build a building out here. It's going to be big. It's going to be nice. It's going to be great. And I've got to tell you that for 12 months or 12 years or 120 years from now, I couldn't care less to be remembered for how tall a building is or how much it costs or anything like that. May this church be known. May we be remembered by God and by our generation for worship and for obedience to God and for making marriages good. May we say, may we pray as Nehemiah did. Remember us with favor, oh God.